Seattle is home to a special exhibit which invites visitors into a thoughtful conversation about race. It's at the Wing Luke Asian Museum, or WING, and it's called Under My Skin, Artists Explore Race in the 21st Century. In it, 26 artists share their creative visions of race. They depict the brutal realities of racism in the past and present, the ways race shapes the immigrant experience, and the hope that can be found amidst the complex realities of race in daily life. We have three guests in the studio to talk a little bit more about this exhibit. With me in the studio is a former art teacher in the public schools and member of the Wing Luke Community Advisory Committee for this exhibit, Sharon Maeda. Welcome to the show, Sharon, and welcome back.
Thank you. It's great
you
to
also,
be here.
Yes, former KBCS as well. So nice to have you back in the studio. And we also have two of the exhibit's featured artists, Karina Del Rosario. Hello, Karina.
Hi, Sonia.
And also in the studio with us, Jasmine Brown.
Hello. Welcome.
Okay, so I'm going to, Sharon, start with you, being that you are on the advisory committee there that helped put this exhibit together. Talk a little bit about the exhibit and how it came to be. What was the idea behind Under My Skin?
Well, this is actually a part two of a series that started back in 2004 when the Wing had a program called Beyond Talk, Redrawing Race in Seattle. And the exhibit was so compelling that last year when they started looking for community advisory people, I could recall every single piece that was in the exhibit back in 2004. It was that compelling. And so I said, yes, I want to be on that committee. The Wing has a wonderful way of curating all of its exhibits. The community is asked to be involved. In the case of this series, potlucks were literally held in different parts of the community, at the Northwest African American Museum, at the Wing, and other kinds of places, where community folks could just come and talk about race. And out of that came ideas, and also some of the people that chose to volunteer to serve on the Community Advisory Committee. So that's where we started. This exhibit is quite different from the last one, and we feel like it's a 21st century look. Contrary to some opinion that we're in the post-racial society, we definitely are not. And there are many things, as witnessed by the Voting Rights Act that the Supreme Court took down a major portion of last week, that clearly we have many, many things to do. And art is a way of allowing people to dialogue about race and to think about race in a way that's perhaps less threatening than a debate or a political discussion where things can get very heated and, you know, coming to some kind of dialogue that really is meaningful and positive is difficult.
Sure. Well, talking about some of the difficult, you know, but maybe meaningful dialogue, give an example of some of the forums that you had. As you said, some of the potlucks, what were some of the things that kind of came out of there? Were there some themes that kind of arose as these conversations went on?
Well, there were different themes. I only attended two of the potlucks, and there were quite a few of them. But what was so fascinating is the people that came were from middle school students all the way to elders who had a lifelong history of maybe eight decades to tell what they have gone through. It was just amazing. The facilitators asked everybody to tell stories, and it might have been in spoken word, it might have been in just telling everybody else at your table something about yourself, and out of that came a richness that was unbelievable. And then some of those people wanted to stay engaged. Others had recommendations of people they wanted involved. And then the Wing reached out to the arts community to make sure there was a cross-section of art faculty and artists, practicing artists in the communities of color to participate in this. And it was, the committee was just fascinating. Some of us knew each other. Most of us didn't know everybody in the room. And we always start with a process of coming up with ideas that we heard at the potlucks or that we just thought of. And all the ideas would go up, and then the ideas would be put into categories, and then pretty soon we'd kind of hone that down. And by the time we put out the call for artists, we had a very good sense of how we wanted to address it. But I must say, when we saw the submissions, we were overwhelmed. This fabulous collection of art from well-known artists and students and everybody in between. It was really wonderful.
Okay, well, speaking of the artists, we do have two of the artists in the studio, Karina Del Rosario, sorry. So I understand your work is about identity in this exhibit, and tell us a little bit about your piece and what your concept was behind that.
Sure. So my piece in the exhibit is called A Passport Series, and it features four individuals who I've known for a number of years and I worked with. And I focused primarily on reaching out to transgender people of color in my community. And part of the reason why that came about was I started kind of on assignment working with an organization called Entre Hermanos to do digital stories with transgender folks in the community. And the very first person who I interviewed, photographed, and worked with was transgender. She identifies as female, and she was also an immigrant. And I'm an immigrant, so right off the bat, we had things in common about what it's like to leave home, what it's like to come to the U.S. and make a place for yourself here. And for her, she was born male, and when she immigrated, all her documents, her passport identified her with her birth sex as male. Her given name was male. But when she came here, she really underwent her transformation process and transitioned from male to female, changed her name. She was actually able to legally change her name in Washington State. And that really threw her in a legal immigration limbo because her home country in South America would not recognize her new identity, what she was claiming for herself. So that got me thinking. And in the midst of all that, there had been continues to be ongoing debate about immigration reform, about certainly in this past week, the Defense of Marriage Act, I mean, all these things having to do with what box you check off on these forms. And so that gave rise to this idea of, you know, these identity papers that or application forms that we're always asked to fill out, they have us check off all these categories that don't necessarily fit who we are. It's for someone else's purpose. It's for somebody else to count how many females, how many males, how many African Americans, how many immigrants, how many, you know, U.S.-born folks. And it doesn't really capture who we are, the essence of who we are. So I looked at my own passport, both from the Philippines and from the U.S. I looked at my naturalization papers. I looked at my driver's license, and I identified kind of the common questions that are asked by these applications. And then I reformatted them so that they were much more open-ended. No box to fill out, but just a blank line for people to fill in however they saw fit. And I decided to work with transgender folks of color specifically because there's so many layers of identity that they grapple with. And the majority of transgender folks, their official documents, their official driver's license or passport doesn't necessarily match how they present, which can be really problematic in different situations. So I wanted to create these passports, which I have an example here. So I took the format of a passport. It opens up, and on the one side is a headshot portrait that I took. And then on the other side, right next to it, is how the different folks I worked with filled out the form that I gave them. So instead of birth name, I asked for their just regular name, chosen name, so they could either put in their full name, their legal name, their nickname, whatever they like to be called. rather than race or ethnicity, I asked them to fill out their cultural identity. Because for a lot of people, especially mixed race folks, you know, your ethnicity might not be the first thing off the top of your head, right? And then for dates of, rather than birth date, I asked for dates of importance. For a lot of people, you know, your birth date is one thing, but you go through so many transformations in your life. For me, the dates of importance in my life are not only my birth date, but the date that I immigrated here to the U.S., the date that I kind of restarted my life about 5 years ago. Those are important dates to me, and they mark who I am, not just my birth date, how old I am, or anything like that. I also asked for gender identity. Again, left it blank. Everyone, even though technically they fall under a transgender umbrella, they identified in with very different words. And then in the last one, I asked for status. And I think this speaks to all the ways, again, that we are identified. It could be employment status, immigration status, marital status. That always trips me up when I fill out a form, because I don't want to be identified as single, married, divorced. You know, I'm just who I am. And so when I worked with the different folks on this project, I said, you know, I interpret status however you see fit. You could even make it fun, and it could be your Facebook status. It could be totally, you know, your feeling for the day, your state of mind for the day. But I don't want to impose anything on anyone. I just want you, I wanted to give folks the opportunity to express themselves through this format. So I made it into these passports. They're a series of four, featuring four different individuals. And I am hoping that I can expand the project, because so many people have these issues of identity, whether it's they're undocumented, or they are adopted, or they are unemployed, or they're homeless. So, you know, this is an issue that I think crosses so many different people's lives, and this is all something that we have to deal with, these papers.
Yeah, I find this really interesting. I'm glad you actually brought the examples, because I'm looking at it, and as you were talking about, you know, the status, I was looking at the two individuals, and one said non-monogamous, and then the other one had polyamorous bachelor, open to casual dating, open to polyamorous LTR. I mean, you know, different, just totally went, you know, for totally right. different things, but also, you know, very much, obviously, you know, defined it for themselves in a very interesting way, I think. Yeah, this is a great project. This is really interesting to look at. I hope you do continue that. And Oops. It'd be interesting to see as you move that away, even from transgender, and move it into, you know, whether it's homosexual or heterosexual, you know, how others relate. Because I know when you talk about identity, too, I just had this conversation with my now husband about identity. And I was talking about, like, regionally, like I have a very strong regional identity. And so I identify myself as a Southern Black woman. And that's a different take than someone who might be from the Pacific Northwest. Not bad, just different. and we kind of, you know, had that conversation. So I like the idea of the identity. That's very cool. And it's interactive, apparently, right? There's an interactive component. So
yeah,
how is it interactive?
At the exhibition, the folks at the Wing Luke asked me to work with them to create a kiosk. So it's a computer where people can go and type in their own answers to questions similar to the ones that I asked in this format.
Well, can they kind of like create a passport then?
They're calling it a certificate of identity.
Okay.
And so the questions are slightly different. And one of them is, it's a fill in the blank, my skin is.
Hmm.
And the other question is underneath my skin, fill in the blank. And so I think it prompts really interesting questions. I was actually there when my mom was visiting from out of town, and she was filling in the, you know, typing in her response at the kiosk. And it was surprising
what did you learn about your mom that you might not have known beforehand?
Well, yeah, just her, when she was thinking about her cultural identity, I mean, you know, she started to type in survivor of Japanese occupation, because she was in the Philippines during the time that the Japanese were there in World War II. And so it was just interesting, like, you know, she didn't pick Filipina, she didn't pick Catholic or Christian, the ways that I think she normally identifies herself in the world. So it's great conversation
that
starter
is.
For sure.
Did you ask her about it? Did you have a conversation with her about it?
Yeah, it's
what was her response as to why she identified in that way?
Well, she started to, and then she backed off and then started to put something else. So we've talked in bits and pieces about it, but certainly something to revisit. One thing that I wanted to point out in the passport that I created, so in a traditional passport, regardless of the country, there's usually a statement in there that says the government of blah, blah, blah requests all whom it may concern to permit the bearer to pass safely and freely, and in case of need, to give all aid and protection. So I use that language in this passport and to ask, you know, to kind of make a pitch for all the people who complete this, that the people who encounter them treat them with respect, and if they are in need, to come to their aid freely, and because we have to look out for each other. This is what, you know, as an artist and as a human being, what I want to see in the world. So this is my way of presenting that.
All right. Well, that is fascinating, and I could talk about that all day, but we have another fascinating artist in the studio with us, Jasmine. Jasmine, thanks for coming in. Now, I understand your work is Byzantine iconic images of mm-hmm. people, so tell us a little bit about the people you depict in your pieces.
Well, I have five pieces on display at Wing Luke. One is an icon painting of Trayvon Martin, and there's one of Emmett Till, and there's two that depict children that were killed during genocides in Rwanda and the current tensions now going on in Syria. And there's a last piece that depicts a young girl that was gunned down in front of her house in Chicago just a couple of years ago. I picked this kind of classical technique of painting with egg tempera and using gold leaf as a contrast to digital printing. I mixed my own paints using egg yolks and wine and powdered pigments in the classical technique. And I would really admire the icons that I see at like the Seattle Art Museum that are 400 years old. And I think the longevity of icons contrast with the short lives of the subjects that I paint. I wanted to depict marginalized murdered children of color as holy martyrs and saints and angels to give back the respect to those lives lost that I feel is often not treated with the same amount of dignity as the deaths of white children are. I was inspired to start this series by, I think, a combination of my own grief and fear. I, as a mother, I have had two foster sons that were shot to death back in 2008.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Thank you. They were 18 and 19. They were shot down by another teen as they were leaving a Halloween party. And they never got to see the first black president. And that still sticks in my throat, you know, even when I talk about it all these years later. And A&E did a docudrama on the murder investigation, and they made it a part of their Murder 360 series. And they titled the name of that episode, The Shooting Party.
Wow.
And they showed footage of Charles being turned over by one of the detectives, and rigor mortis had set in, and he was laying in a pool of his own blood, and they reenacted bullet trajectories. And I was just, I gasped. And when I Googled this particular series and this episode, I was able to find it available on iTunes for 99 cents for a download. In contrast, you know, there were no graphic images of the dead bodies of the children that were gunned down in Sandy Hook on television. The media showed beautiful images of the children when they were alive. and invited the audience in to grieve for the deaths of these children. You felt like they were yours. You wanted to weep. But I think children, when their media shows the tragedies of children of color being killed, it's with a voyeuristic curiosity, almost, if to say, look at those people killing each other, and less about something. It's not portrayed as something that we should all care about, that we should all be interested in. And I wonder, it's like, where was that dignity for my sons? You know, where was the national outcry mm-hmm. for them? They weren't actors in a CSI episode. They were teenagers. Tori had just gotten into college. They had bright futures. They liked to play chess. And, you know, I look at my 9-year-old son, my remaining biological son that I have, and I worry that some trigger-happy idiot is going to see him as a threat because of his skin color or because of how he's dressed, and shoot him down as well.
And that's a heavy thing to have to think about as you send your child out into the world, right? Like you constantly, when you send him out in the world, that's what you think about.
Right. And that's, it's more of a focus. I'm more focused on that than where is he going to go to college?
Sure.
How is he doing on his homework? I'm worried about, is he going to come home alive? Is he going to survive? How is the world going to see him when they encounter him?
Can I ask you a question about the A&E special? Did they contact you? Did you have any idea that that your sons were going to be featured on this show?
They didn't contact me. I was a foster parent.
So
they go through a series of homes. Mm-hmm. Their biological mother was a drug addict. Their biological father was in jail. And they had aged out of the system. They were 18 and 19 at the time that they were killed.
Okay, right. And aged out. Okay, so technically they were adults.
Right.
So they were treating them as such.
Right. And, you know, I every time I watch the news, I grieve for someone else's child. And I put all that angst and concern and fear into my work.
Well, your work is beautiful. I'm looking at examples of your work, too. And definitely, I mean, the images that you picked and how you have them in these wonderful, almost like shrines, this beautiful, beautifully displayed, like you were talking about the children of Sandy Hook. This is an opportunity for people to see Trayvon Martin in a beautiful image, in the way that we often, as you said, don't get to see images of kids of color in that way, when it's been a horrific accident of some kind or shooting. Wow. Beautiful. Well, beautiful. Both Jasmine and Karina, beautiful work. Highly encourage people to go see it. I do have just a little bit of time left, and I am going to give out website, but are there any other highlights, Sharon, from this exhibit that you want to just point out really quickly?
Well, they all deal with identity in one way or another. They're all provocative. There's one that has little sheets of paper that ask questions that we as people of color get asked all the time, like, you speak English so mm-hmm. well, where did you learn, go to school? Mm-hmm. You know, those kind of questions, except they're flipped.
What are you?
They're flipped the other way.
Mm.
And it shows how ludicrous those kinds of questions are. And yet we get asked that all the time, all our lives. And by well-meaning people, not people that are really out to attack us.
Sure.
But they have no idea how offensive that is. And you see it right there. And I've kind of watched several Anglo women standing there kind of whispering them to themselves out loud and watching it. And you see the look on their faces. And
is there a little bit of an epiphany, maybe a light
that's
going off?
Yeah, the light bulb is going off in their heads. And that's one of the really dynamic things that art can do to help people learn to understand each other. It's amazing. The under my skin, the little girl with the blue eyes, people wonder what that is. And that's the fifth generation of mixed race family. And it helps to say where we are now.
Okay. Well, as you said, I mean, obviously lots of great work, lots of conversation starters. I mean, a lot of this work obviously is meant to invoke and hopefully create some dialogue. And I think the work that Karina and Jasmine shared with us, as well as the work that you talked about, some of the other work on exhibit, will actually do that. And this exhibit is running until
November the 17th.
November the 17th. And you can find out more information at wingluke.org, but we'll also have the information on our website at kbcs.fm, as well as this interview. So encourage you to listen to it again and maybe encourage some folks to go check out Under My Skin at the Wing Luke Museum till November 17th, right?
That's right. And also there are 2 days a month that are free. So everybody has access to
okay.
the exhibit.
Okay. Well, so you have no excuse not to go see it, right?
Right.
Again, thank you so much, Sharon and Jasmine and Karina, for being with us today here on Music and Ideas.